Morning. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the 10 lost tribes before going on in the Gemara. Rav Shlomo Gorin was chief rabbi of Israel in the 1970s, and as such was very much involved in the actual arrangements for rescuing the what he refers to as the Falashas, as well as determining their halachic status when they came to Israel. So he writes about the issues relating to determining their status, including the story of Eldad HaDani that we discussed yesterday in a sefer called Torat HaMedina, beginning on page 172. And he asks a question that Yitzi asked. Eldad HaDani describes this wonderful society where everybody is a tzaddik and studies Torah and so on. Actually, I was thinking about this afterwards. When he described the tribe of Yisachar, he said, they learn Torah, they don't do averos, and they have the four misos based in. Why do they have the four misos based in if nobody does averos? So I'm not sure. That's a question one could ask on the story. But in general, he describes these great societies where everybody is living in righteousness and studying Torah and doing mitzvos. But the 10 tribes were exiled in the first place because they were Rishayim. There's an opinion, as we saw, Rabbi Kiva says, they're not coming back. There's an opinion that they have no chelek in Olam Hava. There's even Rabbi Eliezer, who says they are coming back, because he darshans it from a pasuk, but he's not suggesting that they were tzaddikim. How do we reconcile this story of Eldad HaDani and the fantastic righteousness of all these societies of the 10 tribes with the Gemara and with the Psukim? Psukim say they were exiled because they did not keep the word of Hashem. No. The easy answer would be to say, well, that was that generation, and afterwards they became righteous. But then why would Rabbi Kiva say they're not coming back? Why would there be an opinion that they have no chelek l'olam hava, implying, and furthermore, there's an opinion in the Gemara that says the descendants of the 10 lost tribes are presumed not to be Jewish. That is, they're presumed to have assimilated. There's a halachic significance to their status, which was an issue with all the societies, the Falashas, the B'nai Menashe, all these groups that were brought back. If they've been living separate from the Jewish people for thousands of years, they don't have our Gemara. We saw they have a Torah Shebaal Peh, and they say, Yoshua Binun said in the name of Moshe, in the name of Hashem. But it's not the same as our Torah Shebaal Peh completely. We saw Hilchos of Shechita were very similar, but not exactly similar. And if they don't have our Gemara and our Shulchan Aruch, our Rambam and our Shulchan Aruch, then in the technical eyes of our halachos, they are sinners. If they're sinners, they're pasul eidos.
Teimanim
have Rambam. They have Gemara and Rambam. They don't hold by our Shulchan Aruch. They're aware of it, but they hold by the Rambam. But in a society that's been separate from us for thousands of years, in the technical, not making a judgment about whether they're good people or bad people, but technically speaking, they are sinners because they don't observe the halachos that the rest of Judaism holds. Obviously, there are differences between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, but differences are only up to a point. Even Ashkenazim and Sephardim do almost everything the same. As such, they're pasul eidos. If they're pasul eidos, then any get that they were witnesses to is pasul. Which means that if a woman got a get and went and remarried, that her child is potentially a mamzer, her child from the second marriage. So that calls into question the status, the halachic status of these groups. They are potentially, not saying they are, because we don't know if someone got married. First of all, if the Adim were pasul, then maybe she was never married. But maybe she got married with kosher Adim and got divorced with non-kosher Adim. But maybe nobody ever got divorced. Maybe if they did get divorced, they never remarried. Maybe if they did remarry, they didn't have children. So we don't know for sure that these groups are mamzerim, but it's possible. That's a halachic concern. And so all of that had to be determined. A decision had to be made by it, and that's something that's discussed in Poskim about any group that shows up and claims to be Jewish. The first group in the state of Israel was a group called Bnei Yisrael, also from India. People more recently we've heard about the group called Bnei Menashe. This group was called Bnei Yisrael, and I don't think they claim to be from 10 lost tribes. They just claim to be a group of Jews that had separated from the rest of the Jewish people about 1500 years ago and gone to India. So there's a lot of discussion. The first chief rabbi of the state of Israel, Rav Herzog, and the second chief rabbi, Rav Unterman, they have tshuvos about this and other rabbis at that time. So these are questions that have to be determined.
Did he address what we discussed yesterday?
I'm just setting the stage. Really, I'm still asking the question. So there's a Gemara that says that if somebody comes back from and claims to be from the 10 lost tribes, we assume he's pasul. And there's another opinion of the Gemara that says he's not pasul, he's not a mamzer or whatever, because the descendants of the 10 lost tribes are presumed not to be Jewish. That is, they're presumed to have assimilated and married goyim. And if they married goyim, then their descendants are not Jewish at all. So how is that consistent with this story of these great tzaddikim? That's the question that Rav Goren asks. Not only based on the story in Tanakh that says they were Rishayim, but based on the opinions in the Gemara that seem to say that the 10 lost tribes are completely gone, have the status of non-Jews. How can they be living in these places as great tzaddikim? So he says that the tshuva, the question and the answer in the Sefer Eldad Hadani, said there's a story of this person Eldad who came and the things he said, and then the people of Kirwan in Tunisia wrote to Rav Tzemach Gaon, and he wrote back and said, I believe this story with some modifications, because they didn't leave voluntarily. They, at the beginning of the first basis of Megiddush, in order not to fight with the Ravam, they left at the end. But other than that, it's basically right, and I assume that any differences can in halachos can be accounted for. So Rav Tzemach Gaon is a real person. And not only is he a real person, we have his writings, and he's a major force to be reckoned with in halacha. In addition, another one of the Gaonim, Rav Nissim Gaon, seems to have believed this story as well. And the Gaonim were close to the time of the Gemara. They obviously, Rav Goren says, and this gets into questions of how we paskin halacha in general. I'm not going to go into all that in detail. But he says that if two Gaonim, Rav Tzemach Gaon and Rav Nissim Gaon, who are otherwise known as Greek Gaonim, it's not just from this issue that we know them. We know them as Greek Gaonim. If they could believe this story, which seems to be contrary to the Gemara, we have to take it on faith that there's some way to reconcile them, to reconcile the story with things, the negative things that the Gemara says, because they had to have had a tradition that this story could be true. Otherwise, they would not have accepted it contrary to the Gemara. And they're close enough to the time of the Gemara that they could have such a tradition. He points out that there's an interesting tangent in Sefer Eldad Hadani. I didn't mention this when we did it, the Sefer, but it talks about the warriors who don't fight on Shabbos unless they're attacked, which gets into an interesting halachic discussion, because it seems from our tradition that the halacha that you could fight a war on Shabbos for pikuach nefesh was not known until after, it wasn't darshaned until after the time of the Hanukkah story. And these tribes departed from the Jewish people centuries before the Hanukkah story. And they seem to have known that you could fight on Shabbos in self-defense, which raises interesting questions in terms of how that tradition developed, which come up in Midrashim and the Gaonim as well. That's a tangent. So he uses interesting language here. He says, no matter how much historical research will be done, the bottom line is that Rav Tzemach Gaon and Rav Nissim Gaon are pillars of halacha, shemipihem anu chayim, from their mouths we live, umeimehem anu shotim, and we drink their waters, v'divreihem divrei kabbalah, and their words are our tradition. So the answer has to be that the 10 lost tribes can be divided into two groups. And in fact, in the Medrash, in Torah Kohanim, which is one of the halachic Midrashim, Rabbi Akiva, who in our Gemara says the 10 lost tribes are not coming back, in the Medrash he says specifically, as you may remember, when we read the Psukim, it said they were exiled to Bachlach and Chavor, Hare Gozan and Hare Madai, the cities of Madai. In the Medrash, Rabbi Akiva says specifically those who were exiled to the cities of Madai are not coming back. It doesn't say they're all not coming back, unlike in our Gemara. The Medrash specifically referring to the ones who were sent to the cities of Madai. So it could be that those are the ones who remained Rishayim and were assimilated, and that others, in fact, were tzaddikim, like Eldad Adani described, and he specifically was describing the Jews of Ethiopia. That's very clear from his story that he's talking about the Jews of Ethiopia. As we'll see in a second, that independent kingdom of the Jews of Ethiopia still existed in the 1500s. When we did the Maral, Maral lived in Prague, and he said, I'm not aware of any Jewish communities in Africa. In fact, at that very time, a Radvaz, chief rabbi of Egypt, Rebbe of the Arizal, was dealing with halachic issues relating to the independent kingdom of Jews in Ethiopia, a few hundred miles to the south. So Maral, turns out, just wasn't aware of it, but it did exist. But we'll come back to that in a second. He quotes a Rishon by name of Rabbeinu David Bonfil, who was a student of Ramban, who writes, he ties the 10 lost tribes to, well, another aspect of our Gemara that we read, said that Sancheirev did not speak ill of Eretz Yisrael. In contrast, the Jewish people did speak ill of Eretz Yisrael. And he suggests that those Jews who were happy to leave Eretz Yisrael, because they decided that some other place was better, their descendants are the ones who are not coming back. The ones who were truly exiled against their will and did not speak ill of Eretz Yisrael, those are the ones whose descendants are coming back. And Or he could understand that the machloket, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer, about whether the 10 tribes are coming back, is only about that specific generation. Maybe they all rejected Eretz Yisrael. But and therefore that specific generation won't come back in Tchias HaMesim, won't come back to Eretz Yisrael. But their descendants who didn't participate in that sin of speaking ill of Eretz Yisrael, they will come back. That still doesn't resolve how their descendants could suddenly be great tzaddikim. The only way to understand that really is to say they're two different groups entirely. There's the group that Rabbi Kiva says they're not coming back and have no chelak olam haba, and then another group, descendants, so that would be the ones, according to the Medrash Torah Kohanim, that would be the ones who were exiled specifically to the cities of Madai, and the descendants of others who were exiled different places, and as we've seen, they were exiled different times to different places, their descendants could be the righteous ones. So in the 1500s, the Radvaz, chief rabbi of Egypt and later in Yerushalayim, was asked a question. A woman came from Kush, and she had been taken captive, she and her two sons, and she was purchased by a Jew. And she said that she was married, and her husband was so-and-so, and that they were attacked by enemies, and all the males were killed, and all the women and children were taken captive. And that she is a descendant of Shevet Dan, and they live in the mountains of Ethiopia. It doesn't say Ethiopia, it says Kush Hanikra al-Chabash. Chabash, that is the Arabic name for Ethiopia. That's the modern Hebrew name for Ethiopia as well. So it clearly is talking about Ethiopia. And then her master, the person who bought her, Reuven, married her and had a child. And the question was, is this child a mamzer? Because she said she was married, but she said that all the males were killed by invaders. Do we believe her that all the males were killed? And that gets into completely separate halachic issues about what's adequate testimony that a husband died. In peacetime, in general, in peacetime, if a woman comes and says she's a widow, we believe her. She's a widow. But in wartime, halachos are a bit different. Maybe she thought he was killed, and maybe he really went into hiding in the mountains, and so on. So that's not going to deal with that aspect of the question. But the Radvaz, at the end of his tshuva, and this is in the 1500s, says, what is the status of these people at all? Do we accept them as Jewish? And he says, for, again, technical halachic reasons that I'm not going to go into here, but he says that if an individual comes from that tribe, we would treat him as not Jewish and make him convert if he wanted to convert. But if the entire tribe would come at once and want to be accepted as Jewish, we would accept them as Jewish. Rav Goren says that this was the practice in Israel. In the beginning, the Ethiopian Jews came to Israel in very small groups, small enough to be considered one at a time. And the first 5,000 Jews that came, the first 5,000 people that came from Ethiopia were treated as non-Jews and were required to convert. But then when they came en masse, thousands of them at a time, then his psak, not all rabbis agreed with this, but his psak was to treat that as the entire people coming and to accept them as Jewish. The following the opinion of the Radvaz. But you see from the opinion of the Radvaz that their kingdom still existed. Kingdom of the tribe of Dan still existed in Ethiopia in the 1500s. You see that he had absolutely no question about their Jewishness because he wouldn't be discussing first that part about how to treat them if they come to Israel is like an afterthought in his tshuva. His main tshuva is about, do we believe the woman's testimony? Is the child a mamzer? If he, unless he was confident of their Jewishness, he wouldn't have ever had to get there, or at least he would have dealt with that first. So Rav Goren understands from the tshuva of the Radvaz that there's no question about the purity of their lineage. Their questions are only about, since they don't have our Rambam and our Shulchan Aruch, do we treat their marriages and their divorces as valid, and therefore are their children legitimate or not legitimate? Again, it must be that the things that the Gemara says, the descendants of the 10 lost tribes are no longer considered Jewish, and they're not coming back, and no chelek olam haba, it must have been talking about a specific subdivision of the 10 lost tribes, specifically the group that went to the cities of Madai, but not necessarily all of them. He notes that in the early 20th century, 50 years before the question of the Falashas coming to Israel and being accepted into society came up, Rav Kook has some letters. Rav Kook was the chief rabbi, of the Ashkenazi chief rabbi before the state of Israel was founded. He died in 1935. And he has some letters where he's responding to requests from the Jewish community of Ethiopia to send them teachers. So he was aware of them. And again, he writes about the importance of supporting this community and sending them teachers of Torah. Apparently had no questions about their Jewishness. So one halachic implication to all of this is, again, how do we treat them in terms of being able to marry Jews? Are we worried that they are Jewish, therefore there could be mamzerim among them if they didn't follow the laws of marriage and divorce properly, or do we treat them as not Jewish entirely? And that's one of the major area of halachic discussion. There's another sidelight to this. Today we talk about, that's remarkable, that at the next table, the rabbi just said, getting smicha. Because I was also just about to say something about getting smicha. Today, our rabbis have smicha. We call it smicha. But it's not the same smicha that they had in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu and the Beis HaMikdash and the Tanaim, which was a direct tradition from, the Torah says, Moshe rested his hands on Yoshua. That's what the word smicha means, to rest your hands. And there was an unbroken chain of smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu until approximately the year 300, when that chain was broken, 300 of the Common Era, in the middle of the time of the Gemara. That's why we have that's one reason why we have a fixed calendar today. Because in order to determine the calendar based on new moon, you have to have someone with smicha. And they saw that that was going to end, and they made a fixed calendar. And there's more to it than that. The Rambam talks about how are we going to get smicha back in the future. He writes that if all of the chachamim in Eretz Yisrael would agree among themselves to give smicha to one person, then that would be considered as if it was smicha for Moshe Rabbeinu, and then he could give smicha to other people. And in fact, in the 1500s, there was an attempt to do this. A large number of chachamim Eretz Yisrael in Tzfat, in particular, in that time, the center of Torah life in Israel was in Tzfat. People living there included Rav Yosef Karo, the author of Shulchan Aruch, Arizal, someone named the Mabit, we mentioned before, the Alshich, great Torah commentator, the author of Yedid Nefesh, one of the Shabbos Miros, the author of L'Chadodi, and on and on and on. All of these people were alive in Tzfat at the same time, and all great Talmid Chachamim, they got together, and they gave smicha to one person, of Rav Yaakov Beirav. And then he gave smicha back to some of them, including the author of, and that's what Rambam says he could do, including the author of Shulchan Aruch. The Radvaz, in the meantime, had moved from Egypt to Yerushalayim, and he said, hold on a second. Rambam says, Rov the Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael. He didn't say Tzfat. He said Eretz Yisrael. What about the rest of us? And we don't agree to this process, because he says that what forced the Rambam to say that this was possible was that the Rambam says there has to be smicha when there's a Beis Hamikdash. Well, what about Eliyahu HaNavi? Eliyahu HaNavi has smicha. Some say Eliyahu HaNavi actually has smicha for Moshe Rabbeinu, according to the Medrash that Eliyahu HaNavi is Pinchas. So, now, interestingly,
smicha comes from Gilgal to Gilgal?
No, that he was actually the same person.
Oh, that was the same
person. There's an opinion he was actually the same person. But even if he wasn't the same person, he had Eliyahu HaNavi lived in the time, he was a Navi in the time of the early prophets, and he had smicha from his Rebbe, who had smicha from his Rebbe, who had smicha just a few people back from Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, the Rambam, as you may recall, says that whether Eliyahu HaNavi will come before Mashiach is one of those things that we just won't know until it happens. So the Rambam is consistent with saying, I don't know how smicha is going to come back, because Rambam is not sure that Eliyahu HaNavi coming first is true. But the Radvaz says Eliyahu HaNavi is going to come. And furthermore, until we find the 10 lost tribes and see whether there's somebody among them who still has smicha, we can't rule that possibility out, and we don't need to go through this whole procedure of setting up smicha, because maybe there are people alive today who still have smicha and an unbroken chain from Moshe Rabbeinu. A couple hundred years later, that was in the 1500s, in the early 1800s, as we talked about previously, students of the Vilna Gaon came up to Eretz Yisrael. One of the things that they did, in fact, was to send somebody to search for the 10 lost tribes. And they gave them a letter of introduction from the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael, say, the time of the redemption is coming, we're resettling Eretz Yisrael, we'd like you to join us, especially if there's somebody among you who has smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu, please send him to us, and also send money. That's the letter said, because according to Eldad HaDani, they were fantastically wealthy, these tribes. And he says they're fantastically wealthy. The Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael in the 1800s was tremendously poor. And so if these tribes really exist and they're really as wealthy as Eldad HaDani says, then they definitely should send money. I made a joke the other day about, you know, if they really existed, we would have Mishalachim from them. But the truth is, if they really exist and they're as wealthy as Eldad HaDani says, they wouldn't have to send Mishalachim. As Rabbi Yisrael of Shklov, student of the Vilna Gaon, realized, we should send Mishalachim to them. So they sent someone with this letter of introduction, and he spent 2.5 years searching in the mountains of Persia and that area, searching for them in now Saudi Arabia. Didn't find them. Eventually he settled Yemen and became a doctor to the Imam of Yemen until he fell into disfavor and was assassinated. That was the fate of that Mishulach, but they never did find. But what you see, in any event, is that the students of the Vilna Gaon, who, needless to say, great Talmidei Chachamim, they were the students of the Vilna Gaon. These were not just hangers-on. These were the core students of the Vilna Gaon. They believed the story of Eldad HaDani, even though, again, it seems to be contrary to the Gemara. So you have to say that the Gemara and the Midrashim were talking about one group, and that they were talking about this other group, because they clearly believed that these tribes existed and were living a Torah life. That is the essence of what Rav Gorin writes about the background to determining the halachic status of the Jews of Ethiopia. With that, we will conclude this topic, and we have a few minutes to go on the Gemara a little bit. Gemara says, Tana Mishmei to Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha. It was taught in a brisa in the name of Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha. Paro shecheref batzmo nifra kadosh baruch hu mimenu batzmo. Paro, who blasphemed himself, was punished by Hashem himself. Sancherev shecheref. Now we're turning into actual Gemaras to Tzadi Dalet Amud Beis. Ayudei Shaliach. Paro, who a sancherev, who blasphemed through a messenger. He sent Rav Sheka to blaspheme in his name. Nifra Kadosh Baruch Hu Mimeno Yeshliach. Hashem took vengeance on him through a shliach. And then the Gemara brings Psukim, where Paro said, who is Hashem that I should listen to him? And it says, Hashem shook out the Egyptians into the sea. And Sancherev, about Sancherev, it says, Biyad Malachecha Chirafta Hashem, through your agents you cursed Hashem. And it says in the Pasuk, Vayetze Malach Hashem, that a Malach of Hashem came out and struck down the camp of Ashur, 185,000 people. Which is worse? Who's worse, Paro or Sancherev? Paro blasphemed himself and was punished by Hashem himself. Sancherev blasphemed through an agent and was punished through an agent. Which is worse? Machlokas Rashi and the Marsha. Rashi says, Rashi Batzmo, we have Rashi here, the on page Kufchaf Beis. Rashi says, Hu Atzmo v'loya de shaliach loya bizui kokach. Because he blasphemed himself and not through a shliach, it's less of an insult to Hashem. Lachen HaKadosh Baruch Hu k'mochein nifram v'enu batzmo v'lo nitbayesh kokach. Therefore, Hashem punished him himself, and Paro was not humiliated as much. It's less embarrassing to be embarrassed by a great person than be embarrassed by a lowly person. If the great person would send, if a great person slaps you, then you have the honor of being slapped by a great person. If a great person tells some homeless person to go slap you, right, that's insulting. That's how Rashi learned. According to Rashi, Sancherev, he sent a shliach. So it's like, Hashem, you're not important enough for me to blaspheme myself. I have to send a shliach. So Hashem says to him, you're not important enough for me to punish myself. Right? So that's a greater insult, according to Rashi. Marsha disagrees. The Marsha says, we have a rule that we say, Ein shliach ledvar avera. If I would tell you go murder someone, and you go murder him, you're responsible, not me. Because when I told you go murder him, you should have said, wait, Shlomo said go murder him. God said, don't go murder him. Who am I going to listen to? Shlomo or God? So when Sancherev told Rav Shekhan was Jewish. When Sancherev told Rav Shekhan, go blaspheme against Hashem, Rav Shekhan should have said, Sancherev said do, Hashem said don't, who am I going to listen to? So Sancherev is less culpable because the person he told to do it made an independent choice to go do it. So the Marsha says that that's not as bad as Paro who cursed himself, and therefore the punishment is lighter. So he learns the opposite of the way Rashi learns.